This also seems to be working. Miracles.
...1984 and others yet to be held. As a part of this ongoing process, in response to a widespread view that there ought to be negotiations, there ought to be a new pattern of relationship with the natives, the Penner Report came out in 1983, strongly affirmed the notion of bilateral arrangements, of reviving the idea of treaty negotiations with the native population. There's nothing that bars those negotiations in Canada. And then as a product of that, or as a response to that, government came out in Canada with the Indian Self-Government Act of 1983, Bill C-52, which went, I guess one would have to say, it went farther than anyone could possibly have expected toward recognizing Native self-government 10 years ago. It did not go nearly as far as the Penner Report had urged and did not accept, at least has not so far, it's still in draft form, but has not so far fully accepted the concept of negotiation, but it has gone a long ways in that direction. Now I'd like to turn for just a few minutes to the alternative section of my paper, and you can see that I'm not going to dwell in great detail on a lot of the in-between stuff. But I'd like to focus our attention for a few minutes on the alternatives and suggest that this is only a partial list of what can and should be considered by the group here today. I looked at four what I called process alternatives. One can consider litigation. It's a lengthy process, uncertain results. It produces a decision at a given point in time, but does not have the capacity to consider a complex negotiation arrangement as we found in the Cope settlement and the other settlements in Canada. We have legislation as a process that can be considered. That would either be state legislation or federal legislation in the United States. I want to pause there for a moment because I have not touched on this before, but I did have a section in the paper on the takings clause and the issue of whether the Congress of the United States could enact a law which would either place the village, for example, village corporation-owned land back into a trust status, and whether that could be done constitutionally. And I think that I've established with, at least I'm satisfied, I've had others read this, without any question that if Congress chose to do that, that it has the power to do it, and probably without payment of compensation. There may be some compensation element somewhere down the line, but I think it is possible to do, at least the way I've described it in here, and it is possible to do in a way that Congress can carry that authority out. That would either be placing the land back in trust, or it might be limiting the sale of the land, might be limiting the voting rights of the stock, it might be placing the land under certain restrictions or whatever. That power is in Congress to carry out as it, in its political wisdom, is appropriate. There could be a constitutional amendment, and I'll remark about a couple of possibilities a little bit later. A constitutional amendment, incidentally, is what the Penner Report recommended in Canada. The reason is that a constitutional amendment, you entrench an idea in the Constitution and it's there in a sense permanently. It's not quite permanently, but it's for a very long time. It's tough to remove it, and it does assure people of a future without the vacillations of changing political administrations. There is the possibility of administrative action in recognition of native government or native land tenure. One of the problems with that is that that's the most chimerical of all. That is, it can change, it can be affected by different political views. And the last one I've mentioned is self-help, the village of Accuchac, some of the other villages that have taken actions on their own part and can, in significant ways, affect their own futures. As far as the substantive alternatives, I've mentioned that one such substantive alternative is to either place the land of the villages, I would suggest, back in trust to restrict the sale or restrict voting rights. We have examples of that. The Menominee Termination Act of 1954, which went into effect, I guess, in 1961, and was undone in 1972-73 in the Menominee Restoration Act, is an example where land was taken out of trust, The ownership of it was held by the members of the tribe as stockholders in a corporation, or hold certificates. They held certificates which were transferable into stock, and then went back into trust status. There's also another substantive alternative that could be considered, called a conservation easement. It has not been used in Alaska, to my knowledge, in any broad scale, but is a method by which an easement could be created which would be enduring. One can ask, well, does that remove the possibility of state taxation? It does not remove it explicitly, or it may not. That may depend on the legislation setting it up.
Professor Johnson spoke of alternatives. Professor Johnson spoke of alternative approaches. David Case talked of the distinction that he had made between large communities, which can win first-class status and have home rule powers, and the small villages. My view, I think, is that it's hard to anticipate a kind of global solution because the situation of communities, native communities in the state, not only varies with regard to the jeopardy that they face with regard to the lands, but also in the situations and the impulses that animate the people of those places. And to this point in the discussion, I am led to the conclusion that a variety of approaches from which native communities might choose is perhaps what should be sought. For instance, the Federal Land Bank exists now, but exists in name in that it hasn't been enacted. At the state level, we have been discussing a state land bank, which might have some variant form, though following the federal model, and perhaps other kinds. And for some corporations, given the impulses that animate their members, perhaps the land bank will do. So I know that legislators and congressmen, just as an observer, like to find unanimity in the community that is seeking the legislation, and perhaps it's useful to think of alternative approaches, not one over against the other, but alternative approaches from which native communities might select that scheme that is best in league with the future for their people as they see it. And so in my eyes, that's one of the great benefits of forums such as this, and I only regret that I can't stay longer. Pass the afternoon.
Well, thank you, Bob. I might I just return to Charles Wilkinson for a moment. David Case outlined the multitude of local government authorities that native people in the villages must contend with, but there's another side to that coin. In some villages, they've been able to use all of these emanations of governmental authority to assist them in the local scene and to obtain access to resources perhaps that might not otherwise have been available. And I got a whiff of that in the Menominee thing, because you said that in the end they wound up with their IRA restored, their IRA government, their native government. It holds their land, and that means it is immune from taxation, but you said that the county, which is a state government, the county government's boundaries are coterminous with those of the Indian lands, and so the county government has remained and is a vehicle for providing state funds. Is that really what happened?
Yes, the county government, though, is smaller and less important than the tribal government. There are just more powers that a tribal government has within Indian country than a county government. So the county government is just smaller. There are some state programs, though, that do go to the county. In an ideal situation, at least I would think this would be ideal, It might be that the state could amend its laws to provide that some of those funds could go directly to a tribal organization rather than a county. I'm not sure there are benefits from the two, substantial benefits from the two separate organizations. I suppose that would need to be thought through.
What about non-native people living on the...
main home rule municipalities. So it's certainly possible to do that. And again, it may be an inviting thing to do. I think that in terms of making any kind of settlement here, I think you do have to bring the state along with you. Now, in Maine, there was a substantial club over the state. There was litigation that threatened the title, the land, two-thirds of the state that would be brought if there couldn't be a settlement. So there was a very substantial inducement to the state to settle. I don't know that the advent of 1991 puts the same club on the state, or whether Indian country kind of jurisdictional litigation here, the potential for that puts the same kind of club on the state that Maine had a very substantial club at its gun at its head to come up with some kind of a deal there.
But nonetheless, there was some negotiation of
substantial
jurisdictional
substantial
parameters for these two governments, let's say, or the three.
That's right.
Whatever.
And that was really before I got into it. But there was a lot of negotiation, and again, the attorneys for the other two tribes felt they'd been very successful on that.
Well, Larry, you were one of the attorneys, I believe, were you?
No, that's just a mistake. Don't charge me with that any longer. I had nothing to do with it, really. That was Tom Tureen that handled the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy Negotiations and Settlement Act.
Okay, well. Charlie, you had a question?
On the propositions that we have heard today, I'd like to make an observation of the home rule concept, and the first home rule concept that has been applied uniformly in America is the Indian Reorganization Act. And this is an outcrop of liberal institutions in the name of Americanization of Indians. And so American Indian law is not a foreign institution. It is a creature of the American people. They have opted for themselves these responsibilities by their desire, by their choice. We did not ask them to do this for us. So when you take a look at American administration, you Anglo-Saxons better watch out whose administration it is. It is your laws. And so state of Alaska came into the brotherhood of states, and the primary condition for the evolution of government in this country is with the treaty of does Alaska Natives have treaty? I'd like to put this question to rest. Do Americans have a treaty? The only treaty that we are entitled to talk about here at this time is how American administration came in. And we were a victim of selection by the desire, by the imperial desire of American expansion. American administration came upon Alaska Natives. And so the good faith that I would like to demonstrate, and where the good faith of the United States have not been demonstrated, is what it did for us in the name of ANCSA. And so this legal relation.
About it than I do, whether that perception is accurate.
Yes, Spud?
It amazes me that if village governments act as a city government or a state government, they're considered a success. You know, we heard this gentleman say that we've got some successful ones and some unsuccessful ones. And he mentions the successful leaps of tribal courts. At what yardstick is he making these judgments? You know, he's looking at it from a perspective, or his perspective, and this seems to be one of the fallacies of groups like this, or state or federal governments looking at native governments. They have the wrong yardstick. They don't know how to measure successes or failures. If we do things your way, we are a success. But if it's different and you don't understand it, you don't know how to measure it. We're not speaking the same thing. And I think that's part of why this dialogue is having trouble getting off the ground. I think that you're trying to enforce a value system instead of listening to ours. Mr. Case done a very fairly nice paper. Very short-sighted, very Western in nature, still paternalistic. He is trying to put a system that he can recognize. Because he can't recognize traditional forms of governments, he is trying to merge the two systems. Instead of accepting what we're asking, he is again falling into the trap of trying to teach us. And I find that very revolting at times, that you won't sit down and listen to what is being said. Part of the reason for the dissatisfaction with the Claims Settlement Act is not that it's throwing away our lands, not that it's political genocide, as was discussed earlier, but it is actually true cultural genocide as well. Our systems are inherently our culture. And you're sitting there trying to tell us that a municipal form of home rule is the answer? Very short-sighted. Sooner or later, with the crunch of population and non-natives, that municipal system is going to be taken over by non-natives, and then their value systems will be shoved on us. We're not dissatisfied with the corporation. We realize the subsistence economy is an economy that is going. Sooner or later, it's going to be gone. We're not against making money. I mean, that's the system we're going to be forced if we're going to survive economically and have food on our tables. I mean, that's a fact of life. Every culture changes. But there are some things we want to retain. And our systems of government is one of them, because that ensures our cultural survival. You talk about racially segregated political subdivisions. If we are going to survive as a people, we have to maintain a separate political entity. There's no other way we will be able to survive as a people. I mean, this is a proven fact as Western society came across the country. And what's making it a little difficult in Alaska is Alaska still has some of that old basic pioneer spirit. I mean, this is the last frontier. And there's still kind of a mentality that the only good Indian is a dead Indian.
And I think that's what this is going to end up. I think that's the only way to solve these things. I think all of us have an ideal solution, and I know we'll not reach that point. As some of you might remember, John Collier was an activist who really understood the Indian problem. And he was attacking government for its failure to meet its responsibility. And by chance, he became the Commissioner of Indian Affairs. And he knew the problems and he knew the solution. And he was not able to engineer and get through all of the remedies that he saw. But he did get the Indian Reorganization Act as we understand it. And it was a political process. He did get many of the things that he thought were desirable. And when you deal with a political structure, you know that the end result is not going to be perfect. It's going to be imperfect. We have experienced a few years now under what was supposed to be an improvement. A lot of people did not appreciate the Indian Reorganization Act and the burdens that it carried with it. There's some people who still are apprehensive of changing ANCSA into an IRA format. We have had a chance to experience the flaws of ANCSA. And when we address them in forums such as these, they come out. And hopefully, we can craft a solution that will be meaningful to us as Native peoples and the society, the greater society. As you know, every once in a while, we get people who are on the other side of the issue. We've seen that type sometimes dominate. And usually they come out because they want equality. I think there's an association formed here in Anchorage very recently. It's racial, and their desire is to be equal. And usually...
No pressure group, white middle-class males... Everybody knows they're oppressed everywhere.
Right. If you will, just a few days before that, you saw in a paper where the FBI were converging upon the same group on Whidbey Island. I mean, that type of mentality usually advances to the point where the FBI is chasing them. Our society usually controls these types of things, and I'm hopeful that the society will address these things. They look at the instruments that were developed, and they will examine them, and Congress will begin to address these things. As far as ANCSA is concerned, I think the Secretary of Interior had an obligation to monitor the progress of that legislation, and on an annual basis was supposed to report to Congress what happened as a result of that act. So many things went obviously wrong. That he should have had volumes and volumes going to Congress, and we shouldn't have had to wait till 1985 to seek remedies. I think on an annual basis, the things that didn't happen as a result of the legislation, Congress should have been dealing with that as it occurred, because some of the things were things that Congress and only Congress could address. Personally, I'm pleased that the questions are being addressed from more than one forum. Your forum has probably the most credibility. Hopefully, you didn't have an answer before you saw what the problem was, and hopefully that will be how it's perceived. But I do believe that if people who are looking for solutions and offering solutions, I know there had been one offered here, and maybe 3 or 4 years from now, if we were all to embrace it, we'd be all attacking it and saying we had nothing to do with that. And that's the way it goes with these political solutions. Every one of us, if we do have a solution, and I don't have a solution, I'm just commenting on the progress of what I perceive as happening. And I think you have to look back a little bit every now and then to see what happened. And I think a lot of us, maybe if we were attacking the Indian Reorganization Act legislation, do not realize that the authors didn't get what they sought originally 100%, but they got a large percentage of what they went for. And when we look at these things, when we look at the problems that were generated by ANCSA, I think there are obvious solutions, and I think they'll generate because people are discussing them with the idea of correcting. And I think if they do, if the United States continues that attitude, it'll really strengthen the United States because we'll still be around, and it's a measure of their success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hope. I think that the important thing is that to explore all of these avenues, and I think if we keep talking, we'll find that we've got clearer heads at the end of the week. We have to vacate this place for bingo at 4:30, so I'm going to adjourn now, but Rosita and David and I will be meeting overnight, and we'll start again at 9 in the morning. And thanks all for coming today, and we'll see you at 9 in the morning. It's 4:30, 6:30, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Or if you like, I'll just come down and bring your room. If
whatever you prefer.
I'll do that just in case I'm late or something. I'll walk. My office is 2 blocks away.
Okay, where do we go for dinner? Meet in a hotel? Or?
Can you get around on these slippery streets
all
right?
Well, I don't want to walk too far.
Yeah.
What do you got in mind? What's here?
There's lots of places, but why not leave that? Let me think about it, and I'll come and get you. And
is it convenient, or I can meet you now?
I'll phone you from the office when I'm ready to go. Okay?
If you want to be late, that's how I would leave, because you've got a few things to do.
Yeah, I've got a few things to do, and but I should be down there around 6:30 or 7.
We had
good.
That's why they came in late.
Yeah, fine. That's fine. Glad you were able to come. And, it's like bouncing around on top of the volcano at times.
Very reasonable and then the hard guys.
That's right.
I understand you're going to Australia and Hawaii.
Yeah, I need a. Well, I. Well, I hope the Soviet Union doesn't. I hope the Soviet Union doesn't let me come because that's too big a trip.
What are you going to do? The Soviet Union? Or are you going across the very straight?
No, no, you go the other way.
All the way around.
The front door.
You're practically there now.
I know. I was in one village that's closer to Siberia than to mainland Alaska. Some of the old timers there were born in Siberia.
When did they come over?
When they were kids. Yeah, you see, until the Cold War.
people just walk all across on the ice on boats. They got families. And these people this is Anchorage Times. It's oh, nice to see you. I'm glad you dropped in. I was telling Arthur, it's like sitting on top of a volcano.
6:30 at the hotel in the lobby.
And we'll tell Dana, I reckon.
Yeah. How many are
well, they make a reservation? Children.
We'll talk about how
the village is okay.
Right.
I know that. I got the message.
What if I could ask?
On your side.
quiet. Testing, one, two, hip.
Any nation?
I don't know whether they have bingo in Alaska. One of the largest money makers for Indian tribes in the lower 48 is bingo. Indian bingo is successful simply because of the nature of the jurisdiction, and the tribes prescribe for larger prizes, and people come in droves. The tribe of which I'm a member is has the largest single bingo operation in the world. Has a bingo hall that seats 7,000 people. There's been several millions of dollars that have run through that. People fly in. They have a busing system from several states. You know, you can talk about little tribes if you want to. Little is a function of the heart. Now, you can be little or you can be nobody. But the nature of the power to say that a people have the similar powers to the Navajo tribe who have millions of acres of land, and a tribe who is limited in what it has, that is happy with that, I think I have problems with that understanding. Now, the Sac and Fox have limited land holdings. I do not think that that is going to continue to exist. They are in the process of purchasing land, and quite simply, I would say to you that what we have here in Alaska, as best I can understand, is a circumstance where some entity other than the government actually has control of the land. The Sac and Fox tribe has an aggressive land acquisition program, which is an investment in tribal government because the tribe's laws continue to apply to those properties as they acquire them. It's going to be interesting. Now, there are a number of Indian tribes in Oklahoma that have undertaken in the last several years to say that they are governments, that they intend to function as governments. There will be a whole number of tribal taxes. The court just ruled in our favor recently on license tags that were issued by the Sac and Fox tribe. To people who are domiciled and are subject to the tribe's jurisdiction, they drive automobiles with tags from the Sac and Fox tribe. Now, there are people who laugh, and they think that that's funny. And you really need to decide where you stand on that, whether you see that as a function of governmental authority or if the Sac and Fox just got out of hand and bought up from Wheaties whatever was left of those little tags that kids used to put on the back of their tricycle. Sac and Fox take themselves very seriously. They have begun to negotiate various kinds of agreements where there are Indian housing projects. They have just offered to the county a substantial amount of money to pave the road because the road runs long, and then it gets to the Indian-owned properties. It turns into a washboard. The Sac and Fox tribe has said there's no sense in us in investing in a whole series of graders and road equipment. Why don't we just give money to the county that we've collected from our tax money so that they can maintain the road? And it has produced an interesting situation where nobody knows whether they can enter into a contract with the Indian tribe. You can enter into a contract with any little guy walking around in town, but you can't enter into one with an Indian tribe. And I think that'll probably be resolved here shortly, but I would just offer the experience of the Sac and Fox tribe, which is a smaller tribe in terms of numbers and in terms of property, but is a much bigger tribe. And I will lay down the Sac and Fox's laws, the Sac and Fox's attitudes, and the position where they move from to a government with anybody or any tribe in the United States. They see themselves in those terms. They see themselves.
And that potential is there. And that it was only potential in 1971, and the law has moved ahead substantially since then. And I at least am one, I'm very reluctant to criticize the contract that ANCSA was in 1971. Because I think that the world as it existed then was very different than it is now. And I think for all of you, the really important issue is not that ANCSA was a mistake. By today's lights, maybe it was in some respects, but how to rectify it. Those decisions were made in a very different setting than we have today.
Yeah. Rosita?
Thanks, Charles. Protection of the environment is a major priority for hunting and fishing people, such as in Alaska. And from our Alaskan experience, it seems that there is an inherent conflict between development and protection of the environment. And the question that I have is, I wonder how this conflict resolves itself or transforms itself when tribes act both as a government and also as a business entity. And perhaps Browning Pipestem or some others who have had experiences with this might be able to answer how do tribal governments, or do they have and do they enforce environmental protection laws and regulations? And when at the same time they are also involved and engaged in resource development. And then the second part of that is how do tribal developments relate to NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act?
Let me give you a limited understanding on the business development or the development of resources and the interest of the tribe in maintaining some controls on understanding. In 1982, the Sac and Fox tribe, and I'll give you a specific, over all of these years has had oil and gas production from tribally owned lands. The regulation of the lessor-lessee relationship has fallen largely to the United States. To my knowledge, the only tribe in the United States that has a tribal law that is in fact directed toward regulating the lessor-lessee relationship is the Sac and Fox Mineral Leasing Act of 1982, which dovetails with both the federal laws and the regulations that are provided. Now, the federal regulations provide that a tribe may supersede the Secretary's regulations by the positive adoption of tribal law on the same subject. Sac and Fox did so. Now let me tell you why they did that. They have been property owners and owners of interests in mineral production. And over the years they had no idea how much they got or whether it was adequate.
The money to make their views known, and they are the people that ultimately will suffer from this confusion. And I think it behooves us to remember that they are the people that must consent or not consent to any solution to this problem. And therefore I think it behooves everybody to realize that they have to be brought into this dialogue because it is their lives that we are talking about. It is their survival that we are talking about. Those of us that are urbanized natives can function within urban Alaska. those of us that are not will not and cannot. And therefore, we as leaders of our people, if in fact we are leaders of our people, have an obligation to make sure that they enjoy all the success that they are entitled to in whatever facet, whatever direction that they choose to move their lives, because that is their birthright.
Rosita, and then Mary will come to you next.
In the mid-1970s, I bravely wrote a paper trying to define the, remember when we had those task force on the definition of tribes. And from my work up in the North Slope, I saw a movement of villages, you know, unifying themselves into regional entities. And I maybe bravely or naively at that time said that if it had happened 100 years ago, they would have been called tribes. And then a few years later, I saw a movement back, or I saw villages beginning to assert themselves, or to trying to, they were assuming a lot of the jurisdictions that I think a lot of the regional organizations were administering. And I'm not too sure what I see in the future for regional organizations, regional nonprofits, and I'm not too sure where they all fit. I have a lot of questions about, you know, where, you know, I know they have some regional authorities get their jurisdiction from villages, village IRAs, primarily under 93638, give their authority to a regional entity. And then I know that there are some regions where the regional corporation gives a regional association the authority to contract under 93638. So I see a difference there. And yeah.
The one point that you're making about the regional corporations, the profit corporations giving that authorities, is because we have two classes of Alaska Natives now. We've got those that have shares back in the village as well as the regional corporation, and those that only have regional corporation shares, the at-large members. There's no other entity to give those authorities for those at-large members. So that's why in the contracting process they have the regional profit corporations. They can only give the authorities for those at-large members who don't have a real recognized tribal enrollment, because unless they're a member of a tribe, the tribe can't serve them. And nobody there to speak for them.
I guess the problem that we have here, particularly the one I'm familiar with, is in the Anchorage area, where we also have a large population of Native people who are not from.
Tribal governments.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. I think that Charles Wilkinson.
I will be very brief, but I'd like to use that opportunity to explain a point I made earlier. I think I emphasized yesterday that tribal sovereignty is profound, and that it's a worldwide movement, and I ascribed Browning's characterization that it's magic. I think it is. Earlier, I said that the system in the lower 48 isn't magic. In other words, the form of tribal sovereignty in the lower 48 reservation system isn't magic. What we have to realize is that you can take the ideal of tribal sovereignty and put it in many different forms. Perhaps the most pure form is in the form of international sovereignty, where an Indian tribe would be something akin to a nation Then you have the form in the lower 48 where you have the Indian country concept. You also have tribal sovereignty in the fashion that it's exerted in a somewhat informal way without formal legal protections up here in Alaska. But I think Chris is absolutely right in saying that just moving the Indian country idea up here may not be the best form for tribal sovereignty. And two quick examples that I will give is that many tribes in the lower 48 are looking to Alaska because many of your corporations have shown the advantage of having your assets liquid. And tribes in the lower 48 are beginning to wonder if maybe the trust relationship isn't too rigid and that you have invested funds and assets and achieved a return that tribes in the lower 48 haven't. And second is the matter of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and its discretion. You can't get around the fact that there's a transaction cost from dealing with the Bureau, and whether it's slowing up new constitutions, constitutional amendments, or ordinances, the Bureau can slow you down and sometimes stall you. So I just feel that's an excellent point that has just been made, and I hope that there's widespread agreement up here that tribal sovereignty is something special that you must establish, I think, in a somewhat more protected form than you have now. I think the lower 48 form has much to commend it, but I hope you can find something that's somewhat different, more creative, more tailored to your needs here.
Well, just before we move on, maybe we could... Tim, would you like to add something to that, and then Sam?
Well, I could add a great deal to that, but mostly I just agree that's really quite right. I think there's been a tendency, especially on the part of those of us that are called experts, to assume that other things that we're familiar with, these known entities, this thing called Indian country or IRA governments or reservation status, that all of these kinds of things are somehow desirable when they may be desirable in part. Some of those forms of organization and management might be better than some things that are now being done here, but they're not necessarily what one should aspire to. I wanted to respond to Browning's remarks this morning in that way, that yes, it might be good advice to say don't accept anything less than reservation status, but is it necessary to stop there? Why can't Alaska Natives have it their own way and have at least those rights and some additional ones, maybe a lot of additional ones? Why not come up with a new kind of approach that would be more suitable up here and avoid the problems that we have down home? I mean, of course, when you're down in the lower 48, you hear nothing but complaints about the system that we have there, and it's really sort of odd to be in a position of ever suggesting that anyone else ought to adopt that. And that's my primary criticism of most of what I've heard, is this tendency to assume that somehow the existing models are something that we should try to use.
Sam George?
I concur with some of the points made by Mr. Spud Williams and Mary and other legal experts here. But presently, you know, as we see it, as I see it right now in a native village of Akkajok, is that, you know, there's a lot of potential for the development of, you know, a tribal government. And, you know, and the state of Alaska, you know, is in the states right now of, you know, they have not dealt with, you know, the tribal government authority. And the reasoning is that, you know,
We didn't have any jurisdiction. We have acquired all kinds of intergovernmental type agreements because that's luxurious now. We didn't have any before because nobody wanted to enter into one with us. We can talk about our codes and our laws and the problems that they bring. And they do. Being a government is a problem, ladies and gentlemen. It's no fun being a government. It's a serious undertaking that you see and it becomes expressed in these many terms. And there is a balance sheet to it. And that's one, but the first element that goes into the balance sheet is the affair of the heart. That's heavy. Weighs heavily in that balance sheet because you won't do anything else. But it's a matter of the exercise. And I think that the tribal courts are the functional exercise of that. And I'll say it to you again. We have established a court for one group of people in 1 month. And if you're in a hurry, it can be done in 2 weeks. So that's not a, I don't see that as a impossible task. And let me defer to Brother Johnson.
Well, before you do that, I think we do have to leave at 4:30. Do we, Don, or can we? Oh, okay. Well, let's defer to Brother Johnson.
It's hard for me to say anything but applaud the Oklahoma wit and sophisticated intelligence that is demonstrated by Browning Pipestem. I just want to make a couple of points, and maybe we can pick up on these tomorrow if they aren't adequately covered now. First, the idea of moving out and moving into government as a voluntary action is demonstrated by the actions of about 117, 120 tribal courts that now operate in the lower 48. In 1970, there was relatively little tribal court operation. Very rudimentary for the most part. Between 1970 and 1980, there was a major movement by the tribes to enhance, build up, train their own tribal courts. They set up a National Association of Indian Court Judges, a national training program, a very well-run program in the sense that the judges were able to get background training in the operation of tribal courts however they wanted, in customary or other methods.
Do they have to be lawyers?
They do not have to be lawyers. In fact, 95% of them are not lawyers, and some of the tribes do not permit lawyers to come into the tribal court unless they pass a bar examination or a test that shows they know what a tribal court is. Otherwise, they walk in and they think it's a state or a federal court and they conduct themselves in an inappropriate way. So it is possible for the tribe to set up standards by which people will be determined in coming into the tribal court setting. It's just a couple of points. If I've got 5 minutes, you see, I have to say what's significant in just 5 minutes. In the last 10 years, we've had... most of the western states have now recognized tribal court judgments. If the tribal courts render judgments, then the state courts and the federal courts will recognize those judgments and will enforce those judgments. The judgment goes off the reservation. It's treated as a judgment as any other state court or federal court judgment. Another point, and I think one very significant to what's been raised by Sheldon and some others, in the Pacific Northwest, in the Puget Sound area, 13 tribes banded together about 5 years ago to create the Northwest Intertribal Court System. Each of the 13 tribes around Puget Sound delegated authority to the Northwest Intertribal Court System. Judge Eldridge Cochessa of the Hopi, a Hopi Indian, not a lawyer, but a very intelligent, a very sensitive human being, and a man who knows the operation of tribal courts, goes around and sits on the tribal courts for all of those areas. There was not sufficient business on any one reservation to justify the expense and difficulty of having a tribal court for that
particular group. So they banded together, and that court goes around and handles the cases for all of those different areas. Tribal courts operate on the basis of tribal inherent sovereignty. There's a difference between a tribal court, in which, just like Browning is talking about, you can set that up by drafting a tribal code, establishing the court, and saying what the court can do, and that can be done in short order. A second kind of court that Browning has referred to is a CFR court, or a BIA court, if you want. It's a BIA court. They're hired and fired, the judge is hired and fired by the BIA, and the court is controlled by BIA regulations. Most of the courts that were BIA courts in the past years have now been dropped, and those courts have been converted to tribal courts, because then the tribe develops its law from its inherent sovereignty. Well, I think I could say other things, but I think that the last thing I would comment about is that the operation of the tribal courts has been a major expression of tribes moving out and exercising their governmental powers. 20 years ago, you could count on just maybe your hands and feet the Indian tribes that were actually operating, exercising the powers that they had. As those powers are now exercised by tribal courts, the state courts move aside. They say, well, they've got a tribal court. They've got judges. They recognize the exercise of authority. So it is very important to take that step and take that exercise when you can do it.
All right. Tim, did you want to add something?
Just a few minutes.
Sure. There appear to be until the people come in to play bingo.
It's very difficult for me to disagree with Browning, but... Yeah.
Do you want to pull the mic a little closer?
I think actually Browning may agree with the things I'm going to say. I don't think courts are a necessary part of anybody's government. In fact, in the non-Indian world, courts are less and less favored. Everyone is trying to find some other way to resolve disputes without taking them to court. It doesn't seem to me that courts are a particularly successful way in which people exercise governmental power. I feel like there's gotten to be an assumption in the room that unless Native people act like white people, then they're not really exercising governmental power. But courts are nothing other than a way of resolving disputes. They're not really a way of enforcing laws, as Browning said. And it's actually the police and it's other people who enforce the laws. The judges just decide the disputes. They settle the disputes between one person and another, or the dispute between the enforcing authority and the accused person in the case of a crime. But the judge doesn't arrest a person. The judge doesn't take a person to jail. The judge doesn't take a man's property and give it to someone else. Just decides the disputes. And there are many ways that disputes can be resolved. I mean, I've sat in the Onondaga Chiefs Council. They don't have a court, but they sure resolve disputes. Civil disputes, quasi-criminal disputes, juvenile matters. They just call the people in and talk it over and work it out. It works great. And they have a fine relationship with the external white people's governments, both civil and criminal. The Onondagas have never passed a law in their lives. They insist that they never make a law. They don't need any law other than their traditional law. They, in their view, and of course this doesn't apply to everybody. Different people are going to have different ideas, and that's fine. And that's why I think a lot of what Browning said is just fine, because some people are going to want a court system that's something like the typical white Anglo-Saxon court system, but maybe not everybody. But the Onondagas, anyway, they believe that every law they ever needed was given to them by the Creator, and they have this unwritten constitution that's all the law they'll ever need. And so all they do, all the chiefs ever do, is apply that law, decide disputes and make decisions about what's going to be best for their people and their communities. And that's how they run it. They never wrote a law in their, you know, 1,000-year history. And yet they do decide disputes. They act as a government. They're very visible as a sovereignty and quite successful at it. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is It's true, maybe nearly all the villages will want to have courts that look like white people's courts, but there are other alternatives. People can have a way of resolving disputes that suits them. And I know that's what Browning was saying, too, and that's why I come back to that point. I think in the end, Browning and I do basically agree.
Thank you. Well, I think we have to leave, I just have a note here that the governor's task force on state-tribal relations is meeting at Egan Center, and you're all welcome to go over there if you haven't had enough of this kind of thing today to sit in on their proceedings. And we'll adjourn until 9 in the morning, and we're a little behind in our agenda, but we'll catch up. We always do. So we'll see you at 9 in the morning.
I got fed up with even reading. I wouldn't even open a book for a year after I finished.